SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, and SNI Digital, Innovations and Learning, a video journal interactive with discussion in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, are happy to present the Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds, held on the first Sunday of each month. These grand rounds are devoted to global solutions to clinical challenges in neurosurgery. The moderators are Estrada Bernard and James Hausman, and this is has an international audience. The guest lecturer will be John J. Wellens, III, MD, MSPH, who will talk on posterior fossa tumors in pediatric patients. He's from Vanderbilt University in the Department of Neurosurgery in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Wellens is chief of the Division of Pediatric Neurologic Surgery, the Cal Turner Chair in Pediatric Neurological Surgery, the Professor of Neurologic Surgery, Pediatrics and Radiology, and Radiological Sciences in the Department of Neurosurgery at Vanderbilt University.
Well, welcome everyone. I think I've started recording. We're privileged to have Professor Jay Wellens join us. He's the Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Vanderbilt University. He's got wide expertise in all aspects of pediatric neurosurgery, but we asked him to just focus on posterior fossa tumors today. He's a well-accomplished author, having published a memoir, and is often contributing to outlets like the New York Times and NPR. He's reputed to be a great storyteller. So, Jay, welcome, and please get started. After Jay's presentation, we'll have a presentation from Professor Hagelin's group from Nigeria regarding their pediatric posterior fossa tumor experience. I hope we'll have very active participation, and please proceed.
All right. Well, anyway, it's great to be here. Thank you all. It's a big honor for me to be asked to do this. I do have some disclosures. Most of them are research-based and don't have anything to do with this. At the bottom, I do have to say that I have a contract with Avitus, Creative Management, and Penguin Random House. I'm still under contract with them. This is our division, myself and Rob Naftel, who does our epilepsy spasticity, Chris Bonfield, who does our craniofacial and complex spine. We call him our epidural pediatric neurosurgeon. And Michael DeWan, who we hired several years ago to really cohort all of our brain tumors in with Michael. And so we're just a terrific surgical group. Haley Vance is a nurse practitioner who works with us, and Charles Markram is our physician's assistant. But I show you this because Chris Bonfield and Michael DeWan and Haley Vance have made a significant effort into the global neurosurgery space in terms of collaboration with several groups across the world, but particularly in Africa. But before I talk about them, I wanted to talk about Estrada just for a moment. I met many years ago. Estrada was the chairman at UNC when I was a resident at Duke. And we were also friends through Tim George, who was a pediatric neurosurgeon. And he was Estrada's friend and my mentor. And one thing I remember, there was a get together that we were at many years ago. And Estrada, you may or may not remember this, but what I remember is that there was the limbo. And everybody was doing the limbo, and everybody could do the limbo relatively well, but Estrada, that's not him, but it's a picture of exactly what he could do. He was amazing at the limbo. And so I started thinking, like, I wonder if Estrada's still doing the limbo. So I looked up, and it turns out there is something called limbo dancer's bursitis. And so I didn't know, Estrada, if you've been attacked by limbo dancer's bursitis, but apparently this is really the only injury you can get from limbo dancing that's published in the literature. So kudos to you for having been a limbo dancer. And if you have any bursitis issues, I'm happy to send you this this brief note from the New England Journal.
Yeah, the joints, once you pass 60, the joints just don't have that flexibility anymore, so.
Well, it was terrific. Okay, so this is kind of a slide that represents to me what kind of pediatric surgical neuro-oncology is all about. Across the top, you see many people. There's pediatric oncologists. There's pediatric neuroradiologists on the right. There's our surgical team on the left, and Michael Dewan, who is kind of the lead on this now. It's not just the imaging and the taking out of tumors. It's the, collaborating with other groups across the world, and it's also the publishing piece, which is really important to establish and then be able to reflect and then be able to pass on your learning that you've had an opportunity to be a part of. I'm also just wanted to give a brief shout out to Dr. Bonfield and Dewan and Haley Vance for our global neurosurgery program here. It involves attendings and senior residents and pharmacists, and our nurse practitioner colleague Haley Vance goes, but many of our senior residents have gone from places ranging from Peru to sub-Saharan Africa to numerous other places across the world. I won't go too deep into it, but right now, Chris Bonfield and Haley Vance are coming back from Tanzania, and then they also spent a week in Nigeria. And it's such a tremendous benefit for our team to be able to go. I love, the different places that they go and the collaborations that you see and all the patients that they're able to help take care of with the teams there. And when Chris talks about the benefit, it really is a benefit to us and to our teams, and about how not to waste so much and how to be able to do operations in all different kinds of areas. And so, there are a lot of benefits teaching and collaboration, but meeting new people and learning new ways of operating and thinking about problems differently, getting out of your routine and comfort zone and seeing new things. These are just pictures of a lot of our residents who've had an opportunity to be there. And I can just tell you that it has it's really had a tremendous impact on our department to be able to spend time with other centers, learning how they do things, and then bringing that back to us. And I'm just very proud of Dr. Bonfield, Haley Vance, and Michael Dewan for that work. And then Michael Dewan's done a lot of work in this Sub-Saharan African Neuro-Oncology Consortium, and some of the folks on here may be part of that, and you can see a recent publication from that group. But it's been something as chief that when there's just one or two of us, we really couldn't do that work. But when there's four of us, we have an opportunity to have somebody gone almost all the time, and helping and learning in other parts of the world. So I just wanted to point out that there is, as you all probably know, a lot of collaborations, and one of them is with us here in Vanderbilt, and we're very grateful for the opportunity to do that. So with that being said, and with me already talking about Estrada's possible bursitis, I'll go ahead and move on to kind of the outline of what I thought we would talk about today. And I'll also say, as Estrada knows, your career, as you move through this, and I'm sure many of you know, it evolves over time. And so I spent my training years at Duke, as I mentioned, with first Bob Wilkins as chair, but then Alan Friedman as chair while Estrada was. And then my fellowship and first job for a decade was at UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham, with Jerry Oakes. And I did the majority of brain tumors and vascular malformations there. And then when I moved here to Vanderbilt 13 years ago, really to kind of build the program and start recruiting people in, I kind of find myself doing everything. And then, as you want to build and build epilepsy programs, and you bring somebody in who is good at surgical epilepsy, like Rob Naftel, or if you want to build the spine or craniofacial program, you hand that part away and you have Chris Bonfield. And the same thing with tumors. Now that Michael DeWan here is that we cohort most of them in him. So some of these slides will be from Michael because I thought it was important to represent him as well. But I do have a long career of taking care of kids. I think at the end I'll show a picture of the very first brain tumor I took out. I look like I'm about 12 years old. I look about the same age as the patient, honestly. But anyway, so we'll talk about brain tumor classification, epidemiology, a little bit about hydrocephalus and acute management, just because that is such a common way that children with posterior fossa tumors present. Talk some about surgery, and then postoperative management, and then the adjuvant therapy and survival, and how those things are important. So, some epidemiology. Brain tumors are the second most common childhood malignancy. The first most common are blood cancers like leukemia. But that would make a brain tumor being the most, it's the most common solid organ malignancy in kids. And I'm sure many of you all know that. Incidence is 6 per 100,000 person years, and it's the most common cause of death among childhood cancers. This is a nice kind of flyer that CytoCare, a group of hospitals, puts out for the 10 common symptoms of brain cancer. And you can see at the top, headache is common, vomiting, headaches or vomiting, particularly first thing in the morning, visual issues, hearing loss or balance problems, issues with lethargy or confusion. And then, of course, seizure. Now, these are for obviously for brain tumors of all over the brain, not just the posterior fossa. But it's nice to see some folks putting out some public health flyers for people to be able to kind of understand how folks present. Now, this is a complex slide, and I apologize for it. But the reason why I wanted to bring it up, this is for all brain tumors. But if you look on the left side of the slide, from age 0 to 14. You see embryonal tumors, which in which medulloblastoma is part of that, and polycythic astrocytoma, and then high-grade gliomas. And then if you look at tumor types from age 15 to 19, your embryonal tumors really shrink down, and you still have astrocytomas, but you begin to see meningiomas. You see a lot of tumors of the pituitary. That includes craniopharyngiomas and also pituitary tumors. And then of the embryonal tumors, the majority of these are medulloblastomas. This is an important point, I think, and that is, when you see a slide like this, you see a CT scan that shows a tumor here and hydrocephalus, and then as you scroll up, you can see worse and worse. The patient's somnolent, their blood pressure, systolic's 165, their heart rate's low. And the classic question, what is this patient immediately dying from? It's not so much brainstem compression or tumor progression, it really is the hydrocephalus. And so, that's the most common presentation of posterior fossa tumors is with hydrocephalus. And the mechanism is, really basically thought to be obstruction. So it's obstructive hydrocephalus. Conceptually, with malignant or high-grade type tumors or some medulloblastomas also, you can see disruption of the ability to absorb spinal fluid. So you get a what's called a communicating hydrocephalus or absorptive base of hydrocephalus. But really, the most common reason is to have is to if is it for to be it is to be obstructive hydrocephalus. And there's a couple different ways to treat this. There's some data in the literature about people treating it up front with an ETV, or if there's issues with time and timing and ability to get a tumor taken out, then some places will put a shunt in and then bring the person back. Here at our institution, we we'll put an EVD in either through the standard coronal point, which you see here, or through an occipital burr hole. I tend to do this in the OR through a separate incision, just right at the beginning of the case. Dr. Dewan likes to use stealth and put it in from an occipital burr hole. That's just really dealer's choice. It depends on if you want to do one or two preps. But in general, we will put an EVD in up front because we believe this helps reduce the need for shunting and hydrocephalus afterwards. And we published a paper several years ago that shows that when we got here in 2012, the shunt rate for posterior fossa tumors was around 70%. And after 5 or 6 years of being here, we reduced that down to around 10 to 12%. So there's some things that you can do to help reduce the incidence of permanent shunt placement. And I think one of them is putting an EVD in pre-op and leaving it in for several days after surgery. So, after resection, what's next? In terms of how to treat hydrocephalus, the tumor resection is the favored definitive management. And as I mentioned, external ventricular drains are temporary. Not all need CSF diversion. And then let's say they do need long-term CSF diversion, there's two options. There's a VP shunt or an ETV. And again, these are decisions now that you're making after surgery. So I'm skipping ahead just a bit, but I just wanted to talk about, the pros of shunts is that they reliably relieve ventriculomegaly. They're familiar, they're inexpensive. The cons are it's a lifelong commitment. They're depending on what you read, there's a 3 to 15% infection rate. And the obstruction risk doesn't stop accumulating versus an ETV. Pros for that is that it tends to be safe, minimally invasive. Failures occur in the first 6 months, and after that, you can see the failure curve flatten out. There's a near zero infection risk unless you have a leak. It avoids the shunt, which is a need for permanent plastic, a silastic. And the cons are, there are some exclusion criteria, meaning, not all people are eligible for ETV. The ventricles don't always come down. Oftentimes they don't, and rarely the stoma can close or scar over. As we all know, Ben Wharf did a great deal of work in the world of ETV CPC, looking at CSF diversion in kids under the age of two. And that is really that work done in Kajabe has really impacted how hydrocephalus is managed in North America. And our center is part of the 14 centers of the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network. And we're right now doing a study where we randomize patients under two between shunt or ETV CPC to see which one is the better long-term treatment plan. So anyway, those are just kind of things to think about in terms of after resection of a tumor. But the role of surgery is super important. We like to say post-op day zero is the most important day. And extended EOR is extended resection, and that's the most important modifiable factor. And so here you can see operating room ongoing, and then pretty odd, weird looking tumor over here. But on the post-op scan, there's a little bit of residual here and a little bit of residual there. And depending on what that pathology is, you probably need to go back and take those things out. And you can do that. Some places have what's an intraoperative MRI. We do not. We do a scan on the first day and keep patients NPO in case we need to go back and take more out. But that is a very modifiable factor, and I think it's an important thing to be able to get an image afterwards to be able to tell how things look. The role of surgery with medulloblastomas is basically maximal safe resection. Same thing for high-grade gliomas. For a low-grade glioma like a pilocytic astrocytoma or a pyelomyxoid, the extent of resection is dependent on location. So that means in the posterior fossa, in general, we're able to get most of those or all of those out. But if they're hypothalamic or optic nerve type gliomas, then those are not often able to be completely resected, and therefore they're treated with chemotherapy or sometimes radiation therapy afterwards. But for a pilocytic or a JPA, a complete resection equals cure. For an ependymoma, same thing, complete resection can equal cure. Often there's not really a chemotherapy that works right off the bat, so radiation will be done at least locally to that area. But when an ependymoma recurs, that's usually a bad sign. So you really try to get as most, really the bottom line is your goal is to get as most of it out as you can safely. And I think that's no surprise to anyone. Here's just some examples that I had from a large midline medulloblastoma. You can see that is filling up the fourth ventricle, and you can imagine it hanging down from the superior medullary vellum where it has its origin. Here is a cystic tumor, which is more consistent with the JPA, and that's right at the junction of the middle cerebral peduncle, the cerebellar peduncle, and the lateral aspect of the fourth ventricle. So you're really kind of intraparenchymal there, almost in the brainstem more than it's in the cerebellum itself. Here's an example of a JPA out further out within the cerebellar folia, which makes that operation a much simpler one, as you can imagine. Here's a vestibular schwannoma that can occur in kids. We didn't really talk about dermoids or epidermoids, but here's one epidermoid in a child. And so you can just kind of imagine. Some people think, oh, well, all approaches for the posterior fossa are the same. And that's what's really important to kind of get is that they're really not. There's all different kind of ways to get into the posterior fossa, and they're not all the same. And so, this would be a midline incision that you'd have to make sure went, far up enough to be able to, at least do a telovelar dissection so that you could resect this from a very midline approach. This is one where it's midline, but would probably hockey stick off to one side to allow you to maybe sneak into that through the folia without having to get too much into the parenchyma of the brainstem or cerebellar peduncle there. This is would be more of a lateral incision where you'd sneak in through the folia to take that out. This, of course, would be either translab or retrosigmoid. And this would be a translab transcochlear with the resection to remove this and obviously keep the basilar and the rest of that brainstem intact. And so lots of different ways to get into the posterior fossa to deal with these things. But I like this to-do list. Number one, take out the bad stuff. That's good. Number two, leave the good stuff in place, and then try to minimize collateral damage on the way in and on the way out. I think that's a good checklist for us all to remember. So post-operatively, we like to extubate quickly and get an early neuro exam in the operating room to see how the kids see how they look. And plan on getting the post-op MRI either on the first or second day after surgery. Blood pressure control, usually try to keep the systolics less than 120, Q1-hour neuro checks, and like I said, MRI on post-op day one. Oftentimes we have people on steroids, at least for a few days after surgery to just help with any kind of little bit of swelling here and there. And then, like I mentioned, if they presented with a hydrocephalus, then they're going to have an EVD in at least for a few days. When we look at the MRI post-op, we want to see what the extent of resection looks like. And I mentioned before, do we need to return to the OR or not? And then we want to see if there's any collateral damage, meaning is there hydrocephalus that's come on that wasn't expected before? Has there been unexpected bleeding into the tumor bed? Are there any areas of ischemia that occurred or cortical collapse, like you can see in that lower picture there? We make a decision about whether or not to continue them in the ICU or send them to the floor, and that just depends on what their EVD status is. And then we have early mobilization with PT and OT. One of the most frustrating things about posterior fossa tumor resection is this concept of posterior fossa syndrome or cerebellar mutism. And the definition here, state of language impairment following resection of a PF brain tumor. You can see ataxia, dysmetria, irritability, emotional lability often present. They can be sad, they can be happy very quickly, they cry out. Neurocognitive dysfunction out of proportion to their tumor therapy. Kind of the old concept was that it's a transient condition that resolves over weeks or months. But I think it's really believed now that it's something that persists along longer spectrum of disease. You can see here a medulloblastoma in the midline, and it occurs seems to occur most commonly after midline tumor resections. You know, people have hypothesized if it's a if it's the you know, if you go through the vermis as opposed to going telovelar, is that it? Is it because the tumor is somehow involved in the middle cerebellar peduncle? Is it because somehow it's involved in the brainstem? Is there a difference between posterior fossa syndrome and you know, brainstem injury from resecting it off the floor where you get a sixth and a seventh and the patient takes time to recover? We do know it's more frequently with embryonal tumors like medulloblastomas or ATRTs, and more frequent in younger patients. And there's a lot of research that's gone into this. We still struggle with it. It's still something that, you know, is seen in, depending on what you read, can be seen in anywhere of 5 to up to 20% of patients that undergo resection of a posterior fossa tumor. Unfortunately, there's really not an effective treatment. You know, luckily we have rehabilitation groups with speech, OT and PT. There's not really a benefit to steroids, and you know, maybe a SSRI or some type of medication could anecdotally help, but still, it's a problem that we're still doing our best to avoid, and then treating with basically intensive rehabilitation afterwards. How should we treat the patients after they get surgically resected? And that depends. If you look, there are probably the best ways to divide this out are based on standard risk and high risk. We are going to talk about a little bit about the molecular aspect of it in a minute, but this has been the classic way to look at things, which then determines, as of now, what type of adjuvant therapy people get. Standard risk is greater than 3 years of age, with a gross total resection, no metastatic disease. No, sorry, that should say no anaplastic histology. That gives you standard risk. And then high risk would be if there is greater than 1.5 centimeters cubed residual that you cannot go back and take surgically. If that's the case, you can treat that stereotactically. Or if there's mets, or if there's an anaplastic histology. And then, of course, if you're very young, you're less than 3 years old, which means you can't get radiation therapy, then that changes things. And so for standard risk, the treatment, as you can see here, is radiation to craniospinal with a local posterior fossa boost and 9 cycles of very intensive chemotherapy. For high risk, you can see that the craniospinal radiation goes up with the same degree of boost. And then chemo is slightly different and a little stronger, and with 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And then if you're less than 3 years of age, you know, we say the kitchen sink, you know, because you really try not to give radiation therapy to kids this young. You can do high dose chemotherapy with stem cell rescue to try to basically, you know, reset their bone marrow, and give a great deal of chemotherapy. There are some protocols now that involve stereotactic radiosurgery with kids this young. And then for ATRTs, COG has a protocol that the Children's Oncology Group that does involve radiation in some way, just because ATRTs are such a difficult tumor to treat. You know, so here is just a touch on this concept of the molecular aspect of medulloblastomas. You know, there are started off as 4 different subtypes and has gone up as high as 14 different subtypes. But the major subtypes to look at are Wnt, WNT, Sonic Hedgehog, group 3, and group 4. You can see that also, most importantly, a gross total resection does have a substantial impact on outcome. But there are some types like that went and Sonic Hedgehog that have better outcomes, even if you don't have a full-on resection. And that's because of the nature of the molecular disease and its ability to be treated by chemotherapy. And I often wonder if people who don't live in the US know why that gene is called Sonic Hedgehog. It's actually because there is a video game made by Sega years ago that involved this little creature, this little very fast moving creature. And the person who discovered this particular this Sonic Hedgehog gene called it that because his son loved this game. So that's why this gene is named after Sonic Hedgehog, which actually makes no sense unless you know the background to it. I actually, you know, I should have put a picture of the little guy up here. He's blue, he's fast. I don't know what it has to do with molecular biology, but there you go. This gets it's lucky to have a smart dad. You can see that the therapeutic effect of cytoreductive surgery and irradiation of posterior fossa ependymomas. You can see here the progression-free survival with the gross total resection versus the subtotal resection, and then you can see the overall survival. So like we were saying before, resection, and again, this is talking about ependymomas. Really matters in a substantial way, both progression-free survival and overall survival. And then what about for low-grade gliomas? So again, you can see, that's like JPAs or polymyxoid tumors. You can see gross total resection. This is for progression-free survival, versus if there's less than 1.5 or, what's a near total versus a subtotal. Now, luckily, because JPAs are not highly malignant tumors, you can see the overall survival remains really good. But there has been progression within that time, which means the person then has to have either radiation or chemotherapy, which then affects their quality of life. So again, another reason, particularly in the posterior fossa, to try to get out as many of these, as much of this as possible. And then, of course, this year for, if we've talked a little bit about medullos, we've talked about JPAs, we've talked about ependymomas, we have to talk about kind of malignant gliomas of the posterior fossa, which are very rare. And you can see just a profound difference in gross total resection versus subtotal resection here. I grew up in the era where we looked at normal risk versus high risk tumors. And when Dr. Dewan, who trained with us here at Vanderbilt, went off to Toronto and did his fellowship and became a mentee of Peter Dirks and that amazing group there, he came back and I made him make me a cheat sheet so that I could best understand all the molecular issues because they're so complex. And at the end of the day, I think the things to remember is that functionally, most medulloblastoma subtypes, there are really three types: Wnt, Sonic Hedgehog, and non-Wnt, non-Sonic Hedgehog, which is group three and group four. And the Wnts and the Sonic Hedgehog tends to have better outcome, and the group threes and fours tend to have worse outcome. Most posterior fossa ependymomas are PFA with histone alterations, and most posterior fossa JPAs are BRAF fused, which means they're not mutated. And this is a much like completely boiled down version of what the complexity of the molecular aspects are. I'm happy to provide anybody with the Michael Dewan NeuroOnc tip sheet for JW, which you see right here. I'm happy to provide anybody with that because it's very helpful. So, here's that picture of me about the same age as the patient back in 2002 with the first tumor I took out. And yes, the sixth nerve palsy did get better. Thank you very much. But there are many different types of tumors. The most important thing, and those different types, medulloblastoma, JPA, ependymoma, those are the most common. And then you have the less common, the malignant gliomas, the ATRTs. And then the things that occur in the kind of the anterior part of the posterior fossa, like like weird things like acoustic neuromas or in kids, or and that's really CP angle or epidermoids. The most, the thing that our job is to figure out how much to take out and how much to take out safely. And that's always hard, I mean, I'm sure everybody's had that feeling as a tumor surgeon, which is, did I take out too much or did I take out not enough? And too much is where the child wakes up with a deficit. Not enough is the child wakes up perfect, but there's tumor left on the image. So it's really a razor's edge, like Somerset Maugham wrote. It's really a razor's edge that we have to walk in order to navigate the world of tumor resection surgery. But surgery comes with cost. And, if you have a child that has an ependymoma and you know that that ependymoma needs to come out, and it looks like it's partially in the brainstem, then you really have to make sure you speak with the parents up front and talk to them about if we're going to get this out, then there is a chance of there being difficulty swallowing. There is a chance with there being some cognitive issues afterwards. So these are things that you have to just be mindful of and really speak with the families beforehand. PT, OT, speech therapy, rehab, those things are super important. As we get better with the treatment of this, not just radiation, but understanding how the molecular aspect of tumor then relates to what chemotherapy the patient's going to get and how aggressive to be, rehab becomes more important. We have colleagues who believe that one day the treatment of a posterior fossa tumor will be to biopsy it, and then see which type it is, and then potentially treat that type with chemotherapy before any resection occurs to see if any resection's even needed. Because if it's a Wnt or a sonic hedgehog, it may be more likely to be able to be shrunk or substantially treated with chemotherapy. So it's an interesting time to be a tumor surgeon. There's a lot of things that are starting to move in terms of different types of chemotherapy agents. So, our job, again, as the surgeon, is to make sure the family understand, is to, from a public health standpoint, I think it's to disseminate what our primary care doctors and pediatricians need to look for and understand what is a brain tumor and what symptoms come with brain tumors. It's then to be able to create an environment where we can get patients in and get their tumor resected. We have to have surgical skill in order to do that. We have to have communicative ability to speak to the families about what to expect. And then we really need to have, the ability to take care of these patients afterwards with physical therapy, OT, speech, or at least a highly involved family that can help, because rehab becomes more and more important. So that being said, I'll say thank you from Nashville. It looks like this, but it hadn't looked like this in a long time because it's been raining a lot. I think the rain's finally stopped, and so I'd love to take any questions or hear the next presentation. But thank you so much, Estrada, for asking me to speak today. It's nice to speak about something other than the book. No, I'm just kidding. I love talking about the book, but it's really an honor to do this work. To be quite frank, my dad was in the Air National Guard, and he retired a two-star general. He's passed away many years ago, but he always talked about how important it was that people be able to be in the Air National Guard, but also equally as important were the people that stayed home and stayed at work so that people could go be in the National Guard. And that's been something that I felt is important with my partner's really pivot and interest in global neurosurgery, is not just the visiting and the learning and the teaching and but also the research piece. And I've felt like for a long time that my role here is to support them as a leader, but also to cover their patients, like my dad said about the National Guard, so that they can go do that work. So that's been my approach for a long time. And so now the opportunity to actually do a talk to you all in sub-Saharan Africa is I'm just really pleased for the opportunity to do it. So thank you again, Estrada. It's nice to meet you all, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jay. I really appreciate it. Your nice, thorough presentation. It was great. I have one question for you, and in talking about medulloblastoma management, what are your thoughts about the concept of doing an ETV at the time of resection?
Yeah. So Jay Riva-Cameron up at who was at Utah, who's now at Calgary, he has a master's of public health, and his entire basically thesis was on a scale that would help you predict whether or not somebody would benefit from an ETV up front. And I think that it's not unreasonable. And I think it's not unreasonable in places that may not have the opportunity to manage external ventricular drains in a unit or in a setting. It's a relatively straightforward procedure to do. And so I do think that it's a good option for people to do up front. We do not choose to do that. We choose to do that with we choose to manage the hydrocephalus with the drain, but it does mean the patient stays in the hospital longer, and drains do have complications. So I think personally, if your choices are for whatever reason you can't put a drain in, and your treatment would be to take out the tumor and then close everything up and hope that hydrocephalus didn't occur, I think that the sequela, just having when I arrived here, seeing so many tumors be taken out, go home on post-op day 2 or 3, come back on post-op day 7, leaking CSF out of their incision, require an EVD to make sure it wasn't infected, and then require a shunt. That's like 3 or 4, it's like 4 operations. And so I think doing an ETV up front, if that's your choice, to if you for whatever reason can't have an EVD after surgery because of maybe a lack of nursing or a lack of unit, I would rather see an ETV done up front than not anything done, with the risk of coming back leaking CSF and all the sequela that comes from that.
Okay, well, let me take it one step further.
All right.
What about doing an ETV, putting in an external ventricular drain, doing the resection, and then managing them pulls up? Now, my concept is just looking towards reducing the need, the probability that, of requiring permanent CSF diversion with a shunt.
Yeah. Well, we yeah, I mean, I think that's very reasonable. We've been able to reduce our, as I was mentioning before, the rates were really high of shunt placement. So we've been able to reduce ours pretty substantially by EVD alone, and have published that. We've not added an ETV up front to that. The issue is that, and the reason why I think we've not pivoted to that, Estrada, is that most of the time when you have hydrocephalus, it's not there because of an obstructive issue post-op. You've taken that tumor out. If you look at the ETV success score, just the presence of obstruction alone, really raises your percentage of it working, if there's obstruction that's present. If it's a non-obstructive etiology, then that lowers your chance of it working. And so I think that's the reason why we just roll on to the OR and put the EVD in and take out the tumor, and then see what small proportion afterward ends up needing a shunt, or ends up needing some type of CSF diversion. Because in general, based on ETV success scores, we would go on and do a shunt if there's not any obvious area of obstructive hydrocephalus. But it's a great point. And maybe we could use J. Riva Cambron's predictive scale and do an ETV and at the same time, and then put the EVD in and do surgery and see if that reduces. So it's a great idea for sure.
All right,
Particularly,
thanks.
I think it's a great idea for places that may not be able to take care of EVDs, for 3 or 4 days after surgery, if there's a
Right,
reduction or all that.
Yeah, great, thanks.
Jay, let's say I'm most of the world, which is low to middle income country, and I can't do any genetic testing on the tumors. What do I do?
Well, I think as the surgeon, you take out the tumor as best as you can, and you treat it based on if it's a medulloblastoma, you talk to your pediatric if there's an oncologist there, and you treat it based on that. The other option is to get in touch with some of these larger Michael DeWan's sub-Saharan African research group and get accessed by sending tissue off. But you also have to, and it depends on the resources of your particular community. Are you able to do radiation therapy? Are you able to do chemotherapy there? Because if not, then the next step is to get that person to a place that can do those things. But there are ways now to be able to send tissue out and around to get it looked at and get the molecular subtype done. So I think, your most important job as a surgeon at a place that doesn't have a lot of resources is to focus on what you can do. What can I do? I can communicate with the family that there's a lot of risk here and what the expectations are after surgery. And then I can do as good of a job as I can in taking this tumor out, getting as much of it out safely. And then I can, spend my time making sure on rounds afterwards that the patient's cared for as best as possible. I think those are the main things that you can do. And then everything else is an ask for help. If you have somebody there who can do that, who can do the chemotherapy radiation, great. But you need to send the molecular stuff out, you can do that. And there are ways to do that. And I think Michael DeWan and a lot of other places have collaborations that that would be able to make that work. But
Samer,
Jay, be
do you have any thoughts about anything you want to add?
Thank you. First, I want to thank Jay for the great talk. Always great to learn from you.
Thanks, sir.
From the limited time I spent with colleagues in different parts in Africa, every time I go, I feel that the field of pediatric brain tumors should be centralized. And one of the examples are there are two examples that have I found to be very successful, one in South Africa, the other one is in Egypt. Egypt has a population of close to 100 million people, and 90% of pediatric brain tumors go to one hospital in Cairo, Children's Cancer Hospital. And 90%, not 100% of the tumors. Same thing in Africa, most of the tumors go to Cape Town or Johannesburg or Pretoria. And in many other parts in Africa, I wonder if centralized healthcare when it comes to pediatric brain tumors will give the kids the best outcome possible. I do remember very well working with a great friend, John Mugamba, who's a friend to many of you, when I was at Cure Children's Hospital in Bali, Uganda. I went there to learn from the best in ETV CPC. But while I was there, two brain tumors came in. One of them was a highly vascularized meningioma in a 10-year-old child, and the whole hospital had one unit of blood. And luckily, things went well with limited resources. The other case was actually an embryonal tumor, a medulloblastoma. And I loved your question earlier, Professor Osman, about if there's a way for molecular profiling to help the surgeons decide. I do believe in some parts around the world, if we know upfront this medulloblastoma is going to be grade 3 or 4, probably the surgeon should not go for maximal resection if we do not have nearby guaranteed adjuvant therapy to follow. And I wonder how Jay feels about that. If there's a way we can do a spot testing in the future, and I know some people working on it, where intraoperatively you can find out years from now that this is a group 3 or grade 4, a group 4, not the WNT or sonic hedgehog, will you as a surgeon go for maximal resection with the high possibility of post-operative morbidity requiring lung rehabilitation if you know deep in your heart this child will not receive the best adjuvant therapy?
Alvin, yeah. Alvin Doe is only neurosurgeon in Liberia. Alvin, how does this, what do you think about all this? Is this practical?
Thank you. And I like the questions that I think it was the last question. It was not really a question. It was a statement that the presenter made regarding about wherever you find yourself with what you have, you make use of what you have. Like now in Liberia, most of these cases, what we normally do is to put in, because most of these children, they come in at the late stage. They are really sick when they present. So when they come in order to prepare for them, for their surgeries, we usually shunt them. When we shunt them, that is to do a VP shunt, because we do not have a lot of EVD. We shunt them, and most of them, they improve clinically, and we have the time to discuss with the parents for tumor resections. But what we have observed in doing that, most of the patients that usually come with lesions of the posterior cranial fossa that are in the midline, right after the shunt, that conditions do not improve, but rather those with lateral lesions, like in the hemisphere, they usually improve right after the VP shunt. So I think in the resource limited setting, I think what we do is, since we have a couple of VP shunts, we usually, where there is acute supratentorial hydrocephalus, we usually place in a VP shunt and then later on discuss with the relatives on tumor remover. So that is what we usually do there. And now regarding radiation, now we have pathologists in country that can do histopathology. But the limitation we have is regarding radiation. And most of the patients, their relatives cannot afford to have them evacuated to Ghana or Nigeria. So most often, surgery is done for them. And after 3 or 6 months, tumor reoccur, and the next thing you hear, they die. So it is among the many challenges we face in this part of the world, and Liberia to be specific. Thank you.
Ben, you see a lot of cases in Kenya, and you're in the pediatric center. Any thoughts you have about this?
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation, Dr. J. Ramond. I think we see a lot of these cases and a lot of the things he has talked about are quite similar. I think one of the things I would pick out is how we manage hydrocephalus here. There has been what I would say is a shift in the practice of the management of hydrocephalus in children with posterior fossa tumors. And you find that initially, in my earlier years of training, you find that this most of the children were shunted, so, you know, before you would offer them surgery for resection of the brain tumors. But now we really try to avoid placement of VP shunts, and what we do is that we place.
There are key references and charts associated with this talk. We suggest that you take screenshots for your records and for further information in the future. Dr. Willen's references can be found in two sources, one on PubMed, and secondly in a book that he published, his memoir, All That Moves Us, reflecting on his experience operating in children facing critical illnesses and injuries.
Completely boiled down version of what the complexity of the molecular aspects are. But I'm happy to provide anybody with the Michael DeWan NeuroOnc tip sheet for JW, which you see right here. I'm happy to provide anybody with that because
Dr. Osman has added some comments on this presentation. There were three interesting observations in this presentation from Memphis Hospital in Enugu, Nigeria. One is the slide which showed the ethnic diversity and the occurrence of tumors globally. What does that tell us? Is this a genetically based distribution of this disease, or is this a sampling effect? Secondly, was the change in histology of the tumor they operated on three times, initially from a neurocytoma, which then became a medulloblastoma, and after the second operation, the patient developed a meningitis and then came back for a recurrence, and the tumor was a neurocytoma. There are a number of explanations for this, which we'll detail on the next slide. The last point is to discuss, when is enough surgery enough? What is your thinking about this question? Dr. Osman indicates that there is an abscopal effect on tumors. It's an effect referring to a phenomenon where the localized radiation treatment not only shrinks the tumor, but leads to shrinkage of untreated tumors elsewhere in the body, likely due to an immune response. This effect has been observed in various cancers and is thought to be enhanced when combined with immunotherapy. The other observation has occurred, and many watching this program have had the experience where after an infection, the tumor can be suppressed by activation of the immune system. There are other possibilities, or it could have just been a change in histology. The views and opinion expressed in this program are those of the author interviewee and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of SNI Digital or its management. The information contained in this program should not be considered to be medical advice. Patients should consult their own physicians for advice as to their specific medical needs. Please fill out your evaluation of this video at the bottom of the home page on the rating scale as indicated below. Choose 1 to 5 stars, 5 being the best or excellent, to help us improve the information we bring to you in SNI Digital. Foundations supporting these programs supports SNI, Surgical Neurology International, the 2D Internet Journal, with Nancy Epstein as the editor-in-chief, and a web address of SNI.global. SNI Digital Innovations and Learning is a video journal interactive with discussion, has a web address of snidigital.org, and both are free 24/7, 365 on the internet. Surgical Neurology International is viewed in 239 countries and territories in its 15 years in publication, as the third largest readership in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations and Learning has just been published for 12 months. It's already seen in 149 countries, and it's the first video journal of neurosurgery. The goal of the foundation is to help people throughout the world. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Click on the icon, blue icon indicated at the bottom right of the home page, if you have questions, comments, or requests for CME credit. SNI Digital now offers this program and all others on podcasts on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify. Look for SNI Digital. The foundation also supports a medical news network dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This program is copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. All rights are reserved. Contact James Ausman at mag.com if you want more information. We hope you enjoyed the program. Thank you very much.